My name is Emma Connors, and I'm the managing editor of The Interpreter, and I'm speaking with Josh Kurlancic, an American journalist who is now a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council of Foreign Relations. Josh has a new book out titled A Great Place to Have a War, America in Laos and the Birth of a Military CIA. So first of all, welcome, Josh.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's start by talking about what motivated you to write this book. Why research this war? Why Laos? Certainly a fascinating story, and I guess, you know, many of us have heard the war in Laos being referred to as the hidden war, but as you sort of referred to then, in the late 50s and early 60s, American leaders were very much focused on this obscure country. Tell us why.
Yeah, I mean, I think once the war, the U.S. presence there grew, it was more like a kind of like a twilight war rather than a hidden war, but we can get into that. And then in similar to the war on terror today, in certain aspects of the war on terror, like drone strikes, there's reporting of drone strikes, both in local media and countries and by investigative reporting outlets. And some of the drone strikes get significant coverage, but they're never acknowledged. They exist in a kind of hazy, known, not known element. And it's very hard for journalists to actually go and probe very much about it, although there have been some good efforts. And the war in Laos, after 1960-1961, when the U.S. was involved, was sort of like that. It was in the twilight, so not totally hidden. So the question of why this country was important to the United States, it seemed, you know, at the time, the end of the Eisenhower administration, the early Kennedy administration, that communism was, China had gone communist, which was a huge shock to some American foreign policy makers. Vietnam, North Vietnam was then communist, and there was fears that communists were going to take over in Laos and then move westward. Thailand, which was a close partner of the United States and run by a conservative royalist military regime, pretty much the way it is now, but they were quite concerned. There was a fear that if communists took over in Laos, it would be a trigger towards moving westward. Laos had been in a kind of shaky situation since the end of French rule in Southeast Asia. And it seemed like a place that seemed critical to the Eisenhower and Kennedy administration. Also, it's interesting to note that they preferred, starting in 1951, to use a kind of covert war there, partly because I think it was believed at a time that so soon after Korea, which was a frozen, bloody, deadly stalemate, basically, that the American public wasn't going to be very excited about another large-scale conventional engagement, although later in Vietnam, that is what happened. So a kind of covert operation in Laos kind of fit the bill.
When you began researching this, were you aware that in telling the story of the war, you'd also be telling the story of the modern CIA and how it evolved from an information gathering organization? How much of that story was visible from the beginning?
I had written a book before this about Jim Thompson, who was an American expatriate who wound up living his whole life in Thailand and has a famous house there and is known for his silk design, but also has done some intelligence work. And he became, as he grew older, increasingly disillusioned with certain of the changes in U.S. foreign policy and the intelligence community. I did have some idea that Laos and the overall Second Indochina War, the war the United States was directly involved in, marked a dramatic shift in the use of the CIA. But it was only when I started like really working on the book that it came together, the idea that this was really where the CIA began to amass so much paramilitary expertise and became such an important part of what the agency does. And some of those having to do with other things, you know, having to do with issues in the United States and issues with the FBI and the CIA doing things which were probably illegal to U.S. dissidents and to foreign leaders and things like that. But that paramilitary expertise never was completely whittled down. It became central to the CIA's mission, and I look in the book at how certainly now since 9/11 that paramilitary expertise becomes central to the agency's mission.
Now, whichever way or perspective you take on the war in Laos, it's a grim tale. You know, the amount, sheer amount of bombs that were dropped have haunted the country right through to modern day. Even Henry Kissinger looked back with regret on the ending of the war. Can you tell us about, you know, how the Americans eventually pulled out?
One of the things that happened in Laos was that at the beginning of the U.S. and at least the Central Intelligence Agency's significant involvement in 1961, the operation was designed by CIA operatives who did know Southeast Asia quite well and designed the operation to be one where they would assist mostly the Hmong but other anti-communists in building up essentially self-defense forces to defend their villages, to launch guerrilla operations, to protect their society. And the idea being that that would be the best way for them to preserve their way of life and would also allow Laotians, mostly Hmong, but other ethnic groups to be in control of the operation. And as the decade wore on, and so in that way, the U.S. and the anti-communist Laotians had shared interests and shared goals. It was a decent partnership. As the decade wore on, what happened was the U.S.'s goals and the goals of their supposed partners in Laos diverged. The Hmong and other anti-communist Laotians still, since it was their country, wanted to protect and preserve their country. Not that the U.S. didn't want to, but the war in Laos became increasingly more of a place simply that was a charnel house. It was a place to kill as many North Vietnamese who happened to be fighting there as possible, to increase what the U.S. referred to as the body count, which became the be-all, end-all of matrixes of the Vietnam War, and ultimately proved useless, not only in Vietnam, but in Laos. So more and more Laotians were being thrown into the war in a way that the CIA's own operatives who started the war, who really understood Laos, understood how the war could be won, realized it wasn't going to work. The Hmong and the other forces weren't designed for a conventional war, but that is indeed what happened. So by the end of the 60s, early 70s, you had a war that really wasn't designed for Laotian interests at all. Oftentimes, Americans who were controlling aspects of the war didn't even bother to inform some Laotian leaders about what was happening. That was the case as the U.S. began to wind down its conflict in Southeast Asia as well. Nixon and Kissinger, their senior aides, negotiated a peace agreement with North Vietnam and didn't really involve Laos. And so Kissinger had the task of coming to Laos after a deal was already negotiated and basically telling the Laos government, well, you're pretty much going to be on your own. Make the best of it that you can with Chinoy. I'm not sure that actually Kissinger ever said that he regretted such large-scale use of bombing in Laos. He did say that he regretted basically that he had to come to Laos and tell the Laotian leadership, sorry, you know, we don't can't offer you anything else anymore, and we don't really have any plan for you as a backup.
Yeah, so it was the ending that he regretted. But it's interesting, you know, as you point out in the book, that the CIA's internal assessment was that the war had been a success as far as the CIA was concerned. Is that correct?
I should say that the CIA produced actually quite good historical documents about the war that are now declassified, and the book relies in part on some of the CIA's own analysis compiled by their own internal documentarians and historians who do it actually, and writers do, once the material is declassified enough, do actually really excellent work. The CIA produced analyses after the war saying that it was a success in several ways. I mean, one was, I think, that, you know, it was a success in that, this is not explicitly stated in such a way, but a success in that it bolstered the power and budget and influence of the CIA within the United States' policymaking establishment, and gained for it a place at the table that didn't have before. But they're also making a claim in their post-war history that it was success because it did what I said before, which is basically it tied down, chewed up North Vietnamese soldiers who otherwise would have been perhaps engaged in the war against South Vietnam and the United States. That's a claim that some would challenge, certainly CIA operatives who were in Laos at the beginning and who were really furious at the way the war went wouldn't probably see it. That's not a success because the U.S. still lost in Vietnam and a lot of people died in Laos in this body count war. But anyway, there's two aspects of sort of in the book what I'm saying the CIA's claiming a success. One, it was successful probably ultimately in cementing the power of the CIA. The second, I'm not sure, but the CIA is claiming that it was a successful operation of holding off North Vietnamese and Laotian communists as long as possible.
Just to jump forward now, Josh, to the present day, recently in the Washington Post, you wrote that under President Trump, the CIA's paramilitary branch, which is obviously so active and developing in Laos, will be further unleashed in a twilight war. Can you take us through some of the reasoning behind that conclusion?
First of all, I mean, I think it's important to say that, you know, the president has been president for less than a week when we were recording this interview, so I can't say for sure what's going to happen. It's very unfeasible time, but I think that there's been a lot of attention in the United States and globally about some of the public leaking and fighting between the administration and the U.S. intelligence agencies over issues related to the U.S. election. So the fact that the National Security Advisor supposedly had a very contentious relationship with the CIA before and was, I believe, fired by the United States Director of National Intelligence under President Obama. And that has sort of obscured things, I think. And there's been a lot of coverage, like the new administration's going to destroy the CIA or going to clamp down on the CIA. And now that may be true on the one hand. Like, certainly there's a lot of reason to believe that they may reduce the influence of the leadership of the CIA and the Director of National Intelligence, perhaps even reduce the size of the staff in Washington. But their intention, at least as stated, is to increase the United States' global campaign against terrorism and to expand it and step it up dramatically. I don't think that they're saying that they're going to launch a conventional war. That would be very difficult to do, I think, with U.S. public opinion right now, especially since the president ran as almost a pseudo-isolationist. But they have said that they want to push more power out to the field. And that means, as it has since President George W. Bush was president and under Obama as well, that the tip of the sword of the U.S. global war on terrorism is the CIA's paramilitary operations and the United States Special Forces. They handle the drone program. They handle targeted killings. They handle missions in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, and many other places. So if you intend to expand this war in a lot of these places, but you don't want to use conventional forces, that leaves you with an expansion of these very special operations, paramilitary forces that we just mentioned. So I see that as an almost inevitable conclusion of the trend of not wanting to use conventional forces, but wanting to show that you're dramatically tougher in the war on terrorism. And I should also mention that, you know, I mean, that's not a cost-free solution, just like it wasn't a cost-free solution in Laos. It's a solution that might be applauded by the U.S. public because it doesn't mean a conventional war, but it's certainly not necessarily a cost-free solution.
When you're talking about cost-free, are you referring there to some of the points you made in that Washington Post column about how the increased use of paramilitary power can be in conflict with sort of American values and what America is seen to stand for?
Yeah, I mean, certainly no war is cost-free, and any war has costs. Reliance on a twilight war has costs, and I think one of the issues in the Obama administration, and is likely to be continued now, is that there's been little public scrutiny of this because it wasn't a conventional war, it wasn't a large war, wasn't much coverage of it the way there was in the Iraq war. And so I would never say that war doesn't have cost, but I'm just saying that it hasn't resonated very much with the places where they feel the effect, which is why public approval of drone strikes in places like Pakistan and Yemen is like on virtually zero, which is not surprising. The costs are just not well perceived in the United States, and I expect that to continue. And those costs are, if you conduct a twilight war with little oversight, you run perhaps a greater risk of serious abuses than a conventional war with regular oversight and journalists able to actually cover it. I think that's clear from what we've seen going back to 2001, 2002, if you include rendition, black sites, torture, some of the alleged abuses by special forces and SEAL Team 6. The second is, you know, if you rely on a very, very small group of men and women in these two groups of the CIA and the armed forces to basically be your Praetorian guard and take on the lion's share of hunting and killing, you're probably going to trash them as well. And I think there's evidence for that as well in the reporting on this by the New York Times, The Intercept, and others that suggested that those folks who've been in these operations after a few years of them, their bodies and minds are permanently trashed. So that's number two. And, you know, the third thing is, with a twilight war, with no clear authorization or oversight from Congress, it becomes impossible really to state, and I think this is again a problem that's been under Obama and it's going to continue. What's the objective of the war, and how is the war defined, and when can you declare an end? Without a declared war and with no real oversight, the quote unquote war could go on forever.
There's certainly some fascinating parallels between the Twilight War. That is how you referred to the Laos War as war as well, wasn't it? As the Twilight War and the Twilight War of more recent times.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure actually. I think in the book I probably do refer to it many times as the Secret War and the Hidden War, but also the Twilight War. But I like Twilight because there was some reporting of the Laos War, but journalists were unable to most of the time get up to where most of the conflict was happening. And Congress people didn't investigate too much for about a decade. They would go up for a couple occasional visits and see the operation briefly for a day and come back. And no one pushed too hard, but so it was kind of known, but not really. And that's why it's similar in some ways to the United States' war on terror today. There's some reporting. Sometimes it's really good reporting. Sometimes that reporting comes out years later, but it's murky. The details aren't really well known, and the U.S. public is never really given a full accounting, and there's never really even the type of accounting that would allow Congress to make a reasoned decision.
It's amazing to look back and look forward through the same lens and through the lens of the research you've done into the war in Laos, Josh. So thanks very much for your time today, and perhaps we can talk again as the Trump administration continues.